supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Toxic chemicals found in firefighting foam and Teflon have been showing up in high levels in groundwater near former military bases in Bucks and Montgomery counties. Now they're showing up in other water sources in the region as well. WHYY's Dana Bate reports.
In the past month, Aqua Pennsylvania has taken two of its wells in Montgomery County offline due to elevated levels of PFAS. Those are the group of chemicals that have been connected to health concerns like liver damage and high cholesterol, and potentially cancer. The PFAS levels in Upper Dublin and North Hills were both below the federal standard of 70 parts per trillion. But a report in June from the CDC suggested that a safe standard would be far lower.
Nobody knows what to make of the numbers, quite frankly.
That's North Hills Commissioner Mike Thompson. He and fellow residents started noticing elevated PFAS numbers earlier this summer. But since the levels were below the EPA standard and above what the CDC recommends, people had a lot of questions.
It's just been a confusing mess of, you know, is the water safe and what should I do? And getting guidance from federal officials has been a bit of a challenge.
Officials from Aqua say yes, the water is safe. But they have also been frustrated by a lack of answers from regulators. Christopher Crockett is Aqua's chief environmental officer. He says the company took the two wells offline voluntarily to get ahead of the situation.
We're just doing this as an extra precaution and also to help address our customer concerns and anticipating at some point there will be some kind of regulation. So we want to move in the right direction.
Aqua is installing a filtration system in both wells. Upper Dublin should be back online in about 6 months. North Hills will take longer. In the meantime, they are both getting water from the nearby Abington well. Dana Bate, WHYY News.
The developmental difference between age 5 and 6 is potentially profound enough to make many parents consider holding their child back from kindergarten. Joining me to look at the practice of redshirting is Inquirer reporter Anna Orso. She looked into the extent to which the practice actually benefits kids. Anna, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, why the term redshirting?
So this actually stems from college sports. Anybody who follows that might know. Essentially, it's when you are out of eligibility for a year at the beginning of your career in order to become stronger and whatnot and extend your eligibility.
So this more appropriately, though, pertains to cognitive and emotional development rather than athletic.
Correct. And social and physical and really anything else.
And so what are some of the variables by which a parent decides whether to hold their kid back?
This is most common among kids with summertime birthdays, July, August, September birthdays, birthdays who fall right around that sort of cutoff date.
Because the cutoff is typically
September 1st. So if you're born around August 25th, you would be by far the youngest kid in your class and perhaps nearly a year younger than some of the other students in your class. So some parents decide to hold off on enrolling their child for another year because there's a perception that they might, you know, perform better.
In kindergarten, first grade, or are they looking at the long term?
Well, that depends. I mean, some parents, I'm sure, are looking at the long term, but a lot of parents are really just thinking about kindergarten or first grade. They think, you know, I can't see my child who just turned 5 sitting in a classroom all day.
So what studies have come out substantiating the various ways this could go?
There have been a number of studies that have looked at this, and the results aren't at all consistent. But many of the most recent studies, including one of the largest studies that I featured in my story, was based on data from 2010 through 2012. That showed that basically by middle school, the benefits of redshirting a child actually dissipated, at least in terms of academic performance, and the kids were back to performing average or even below average.
Even below average?
Yes, yes.
Implying that it could be detrimental to take that course of action those many years prior?
Yeah, so the same study actually found that some younger students actually ended up outperforming older students over the years. So maybe that child who had that August birthday might have struggled in kindergarten, first grade, even second grade, but maybe by middle school, in a lot of cases, ended up academically outperforming the older kids. It's a similar phenomenon to when you grow up with an older sibling. You're sort of striving to reach their achievement level and end up surpassing them.
Did you find that the practice was becoming more prolific?
Not necessarily. People just seem to be talking about it more, but I'm not sure that it's actually occurring more. Overall, only about 6% of kids are redshirted, and that's been pretty consistent for the last 15 years or so, according to the research that we looked at.
Why do you suspect people are talking about it more?
The researchers that I talk to say that people today are more concerned about competition, perhaps. Maybe they're thinking, I want my kid to perform better, or I want my kid to be at an advantage. And so perhaps that's why people are talking about it more.
Anna, to what extent does this break down by gender and income?
Well, this is absolutely most common among boys, and I think that's because the perception and somewhat the reality is that boys mature a little bit more slowly than girls do, at least right off the bat when they're in that 5 and 6 year range. But this is also much more common in suburban areas, particularly among highly educated, high income parents. When we look at boys with summer birthdays and parents with a bachelor's degree or higher, it's actually about 20% of them are redshirted.
Is it because there's a greater likelihood that they were redshirted as children, or they just come to believe that there's a benefit in holding back?
What we see is that higher income families are more able to afford to pay for another year of pre-K or daycare, whereas lower income families may not have an option other than to send their child off to kindergarten.
So what is the counter argument to redshirting for those who are not proponents of it or actually against it?
Well, the counter argument is that in many cases it can also cause behavioral problems for kids. Some researchers and social psychologists say that if a kid ends up being bored because they didn't need to be redshirted, then they can act out, and that can cause behavioral problems, particularly down the line.
Thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks again.
Inquirer reporter Anna Orso. The town of Phoenixville was built up around its steel foundry and railroad station. Both closed in the early 1980s and sent the Chester County borough into a depression. The foundry's reopening as a wedding venue helped to kickstart Phoenixville's renewal. Now, as Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, the town wants to complete its rebirth and bring back passenger trains.
A bit before dusk on this gray and muggy Tuesday night, a familiar sight comes rumbling through the east end of Phoenixville. It's another freight train, chugging along slowly, stretching as far as the eye can see. These Norfolk Southern trains run pretty regularly through town, heading to and from Philadelphia by way of Norristown. For much of Phoenixville's history, trains like this would stop here to load up on locally produced steel and ceramics or to drop off passengers. The trains don't stop here anymore. They haven't in almost 40 years. But a group of local business and civic leaders think they can convince Norfolk Southern and SEPTA to restore regional rail service to the town.
Absolutely.
That's Mayor Peter Urschler using one of his favorite words. He begins nearly every sentence with,
absolutely.
That the town's mayor has such a positive can-do spirit is probably a good thing, considering the circumstances around the train. You see, in the last 20 years, there have been at least 3 serious proposals to restore passenger rail service to Phoenixville. It's been studied to death. And every time, the planners and politicians decided it would cost too much. One plan was nearly $200 million, another more than $2 billion. It would take at least a decade, and to pay for it, you'd have to raise taxes or tolls on nearby roads. Basically, it's impossible.
What we have found, of course, is it is extremely possible.
Here's a new plan. For about a year or two, Phoenixville would try running SEPTA region rail trains on those freight tracks over on the east side of town. They'd put up a temporary station in Phoenixville, plus 2 more in Valley Forge and King of Prussia. And it'll be cheap. Urschler says just $15 million for construction and under $3 million a year to operate.
The infrastructure exists. It's not unusual to do demonstration projects like this, and the cost is not insurmountable.
The problem is, rail experts disagree.
extending the Norristown line to Phoenixville, three stations, no, that's not a realistic cost.
Greg Kirkowitz is a senior transportation planner at the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission. He points at all the old plans and says there's a reason why they didn't happen.
Something that every study has sort of come up against and never quite found a way to resolve is coming to an agreement with Norfolk Southern on what it would cost to operate on their line and then whether you still get enough out of the transit project to make it worthwhile.
But the guy paying to study this new proposal has no patience for the naysayers.
If you ask somebody why this can't happen, 96% of the time they will give you an answer that is not relevant or had anything to do with any ounce of reality of why it could or could not happen.
Manny Demutis is on a first-name basis with the waitstaff here at the Iron Hill Brewery on Bridge Street. That's partly because Phoenixville's such a small town, and he's a lifelong resident. Demutis remembers when the train stopped and the factories closed.
Ninth going into 10th grade, all the jobs left. So imagine going to school in 10th grade and half your friends aren't there.
After college, Demutis was tending bar and coaching football, unsure what he'd end up doing with his life. He wound up on Phoenixville's planning commission and soon got interested in development. It was 1999.
And Phoenixville was destitute at the time.
But Manny's first project, this bar and some apartments around it, were a big hit. Bigger than he ever imagined.
I thought to myself, who the hell wants to buy an apartment in Phoenixville? And they all sold out like in two sales hours. So there was this pent-up demand of people were waiting for Phoenixville to be great. Very similar to the train.
Since this brewery first opened, a barrel more have flooded downtown, drawing thousands of new residents and their cars. All that traffic threatens to choke the town's growth, hence the train. The plan is to start small. The trains would run just a few times a day around the rush hours. If passengers fill the trains, it'll prove there's demand. And that would change the cost-benefit analysis around building a better but more expensive rail extension. Phoenixville's consultant says the project could get up and running in just 2 years. And by renting the freight tracks instead of building new ones, the price would be less than a tenth of what similar rail projects cost. Building transportation infrastructure that fast and that cheap would be revolutionary. To compare, SEPTA spent more than a decade and $8 million just studying a light rail extension to King of Prussia. Nothing's been built yet, and there's a chance nothing ever will. Phoenixville still has a lot to figure out. The town needs to find locations for the stations, and they need to get Norfolk Southern, SEPTA, and all the other stakeholders to sign off. Still, despite all the pessimism and potential pitfalls, Urshler thinks the Phoenixville spirit will find a way.
Absolutely.
Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
The African American Museum in Philadelphia is thriving, but that's not the case for three smaller African American museums in the city. Keshler Tiber recently wrote an article in the Hidden City Daily on their struggle and joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Keshler, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Take us first to the Port Richmond neighborhood and the Lest We Forget Slavery Museum.
It's a very unassuming neighborhood. It's blue collar. Actually, funny, my first job was actually being a security guard. So when I realized there was an actual museum in one of the warehouses, I was amazed. Walking inside, it's still unassuming until you get into the back section of the museum. And then you start to see it. You start seeing slave collar. You start seeing posters. And when I saw it, I was just blown away. It made me go from, okay, slavery happened from this period to this period, to, wow, I'm holding a slave collar in my hand. This is how heavy it actually feels. Can I imagine this around my neck? So when I go back into that narrative, I can feel the weight of it. I can feel almost those, like I'm being choked. I can feel like it was a shackle around my waist. I can feel myself being compressed in the bottom of a slave ship. And that was the experience that I felt there. And I, as soon as I was there for the first time and I went through the whole, like the beginning to the end, I said, why don't more people know about this? Like, why aren't they coming out here? What's going on? What's going on?
So let me put that back to you. Why don't more people know about it?
It's a good question. I could say, like, maybe their location is a bit of it. Marketing, advertising. A lot of the money that goes into the museum is out of pocket. And sometimes all they can do is they have enough money just to keep the roof over their head.
And they, in this case, is specifically the Ragsdale family?
The Ragsdale family, yes, in that case. And also the Paul Robeson Museum as well as the Dahl Museum, and I started seeing this like similarity between various museums. They just have enough to keep the door open, and you know, maybe they can find interns to help out on the tours. But I realized with a lot of museums, it's a bit of a pay for play. You if you have the money, yes, you can get the marketing out there and get more people. But sometimes it's down to, should I pay for the utility bill or should I market?
So let's go next to Broad and Dauphin, the Philadelphia Dahl Museum.
Yes. It's a beautiful little museum. It evolved from a personal collection over like 20 years. You walk in and it's almost madness, like beautiful madness. There's dolls everywhere. Once again, I found myself saying, why don't more people know about this? Yeah, here we are in Susquehanna and Dauphin. That's the cross street that's nearby. And I said, why don't more people know? Like, what's going on? She's been at it for so long and people haven't really coming out. And now the hours of operation are like shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and her husband's not feeling so well. So now she's going to focus on taking care of her husband and retiring. And I said, well, what happens next?
And then a variation on the same theme, I'm wondering, in West Philadelphia, the Paul Robeson House Museum.
It's the same thing. I wrote this article because I was a bit frustrated. I feel like as though when people look at people of color, they kind of lump everyone together. I get that remark myself a lot of times, where it's like they say, like, I don't sound like them. And I say them. It's like, you don't sound like those other guys. And I say, well, the other guys, I sound like me. And here at the Paul Robeson Museum, you have the story of this gentleman who lived his life saying, oh, man, River did so much, like went to Russia, you know, did all of this. Here's a story. Here's an example of a person. He doesn't fit the mold of other African-Americans, but it's an interesting narrative. You get the feel like, you know, African-Americans shouldn't be all lumped together. There's an individual person, an individual story. Now that you learned about him and where he come from, there are other people like that as well. And you start wanting to learn more.
What was your experience then visiting the African-American Museum in Philadelphia, just blocks from our studio?
It's a nice museum, but it's a start. It's like when you go to school for the first time and they give you introduction to algebra, introduction to that. It left me wanting more, and I felt as though I wasn't getting enough. It was just an overview of everything and not really focused on individual people. And at those other museums, we can focus on this time period. We can focus on this person, hear their story, and then we can contrast to another person and hear that person's story and life. And now you start seeing a full and complete picture.
Of course, ironically, these family-run museums, I presume they're not museum curators by trade or by academic pursuit. They just know how to display and entice.
Yeah, similar with all three, is they just kind of fell into it. It's like a passion. With Mr. Ragsdale, it became his great uncle Bub. He found his chest after he passed away, and he opened his chest and he found his slave garb. He found his shackles. From that moment, it's like, wow, it changed his life. And so he started collecting and started learning more. And then his wife got involved and the whole family got involved. And it evolved organically from a passion to something else. So for each case, it's just a passion became a career.
As we're speaking, what is the status today of those three museums? Is the Lest We Forget Slavery Museum even open?
It is closed currently in Port Richmond. I last talked to Mr. Ragsdale a few days ago. Looks like they have a new temporary location that will be opening up in Germantown after September 15th. Paul Robeson Museum still open. Hours vary. Dahl Museum, that's my biggest worry. Her husband is very ill. They're getting older. I don't know all three of them that this museum is going to be closed permanently, and I don't want to see it happen. I've heard mention of maybe like some item being loaned out to another museum, but I want to see all of it.
Keshler, thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Keshler Tibert, his article in Hidden City Daily is entitled Black History Museum's Struggle to Survive Amid Philly Revival. Today, Philadelphia radio station WURD celebrated the legacy of its founder, the late physician, philanthropist, and entrepreneur, Dr. Walter P. Lomax, Jr., who died in 2013. The all-day event included workshops centered around health, wealth, and black empowerment, all of which were central to Lomax's work. WHYY's Darrell C. Murphy reports.
Lomax's daughter, Sarah Lomax Reese, says starting a radio station wasn't initially in her father's plans. But the 15-year-old station remains as his most visible achievement.
Now, this is the piece that's kind of carrying his legacy into the public domain.
Lomax Reese is now WURD's president and CEO. Before founding one of the few independent black-owned radio stations in 2003, her father was a revered businessman in the city. Lomax's rise started in South Philly, where he ran his own medical practice out of a row home and even treated Martin Luther King Jr. when he traveled through the city in 1968. He expanded the practice to a six-site operation with 22 other physicians. He established businesses that provided health care to underserved communities, including the incarcerated. Lomax made a fortune for both him and his family, but according to those close to him, he was just as generous as he was enterprising. Mike Thomas worked with Lomax for many years and says he was always willing to help up-and-coming black businesses.
He's always saying, business, watch your money, invest in things, invest in other African-Americans, because you gotta pay it forward.
Today, Lomax's wife, Beverly, and his five children are continuing his business legacy. In addition to WURD, the family-owned businesses include an investment fund, a real estate company, and a philanthropic organization. Lomax Reese says for her family, economic empowerment is the goal.
Because that was really at his core, his belief that economic empowerment was really, in a capitalistic society, the pathway to liberation and full equality.
For WHYY, Daryl C. Murphy.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.